Okay. Welcome, everyone. It wouldn't be a university event without a bit of tech misbehaviour. So welcome, everyone. Welcome to Sheffield and to the University of Sheffield Animal Studies Research Centre. My name is Bob Mackay. I'm absolutely delighted to see everyone here. I'm one of the co-directors of the centre. And we're really happy to be hosting this British Animal Studies Network meeting on the theme of conserving. And one of the, I'm not going to talk for more than about another 15 seconds here. One of the things that we're hoping to do with the centre, which is newly founded really, is try and find ways to facilitate a dialogue between different and sometimes competing ways of thinking about animal value or the value of animals, and in particular to help develop the and increase the influence of research and scholarship from the broad field of animal studies on wider discourses around ecology or ecology and sustainability. And we're very keen to see that and happy to see that hopefully happening over these 2 days. So I also have the pleasure of introducing Helen Tiffin, who's our opening keynote today. And Helen is an adjunct professor of English at the University of Wollongong in Australia, and is a hugely influential figure in literary animal studies, having published several important essays and books, including the marvellous Postcolonial Eco-Criticism, which she co-wrote with Graham Huggan. A number of other works that I would really encourage people to check out, because they're both fascinating and delightful, such as the co-written Wild Man from Borneo, A Cultural History of the Orangutan, and other an edited collection, Five Emus to the King of Siam, Environment and Empire. She's talking to us today about animal, I'm trying to remember the title, it's Animal Welfare, Conservation and Animal Welfare. And with that, please welcome Helen Tiffin.
Thank you, Robert, and thank everybody for coming. And what started out as a terrible day, but has become quite a beautiful day. Is it all right if I put that piece over here? I think the technology problem arises from the fact that I'm a non-technophobe. If I get near anything related to technology, it can be guaranteed to go wrong. I want to talk at the beginning of this conference about what it seems to be an almost intractable problem, the one I raised in my abstract, and that's discussed in an article by Sargoff, who you might already know, his article called Animal Liberation and Environmental Ethics: Bad Marriage, Quick Divorce. It's one of those great titles, so if you don't know it. There's been quite a bit of work increasingly done on this area, as the two areas have unfortunately moved apart. Animal liberation, he calls it. I would change that now, not exactly to animal liberation, which has a specific thing in mind, but more animal consideration or animal welfare, bad marriage, quick divorce, as the two areas move apart. Specifically, the consideration of species and ecosystems on the one hand, and what we might broadly term individual animal consideration or welfare on the other. One, of course, is often directly related to the other. Habitat loss, for instance, for animals, whether individuals or species, is obviously something that both areas address. But nevertheless, a lot of conflict arises between them. Philosopher Freya Matthews extends Sargoff's implications of this discussion by going beyond this unfortunate split to look at the background of ethics itself in her excellent article, The Anguish of Wildlife Ethics. She begins by asking the question, animal ethics versus ecological ethics. And drawing on her own experience as what she calls the manager of my own biodiversity reserve. She's not actually managing a biodiversity reserve, but she bought a large property. And she says, going on my own experience as the manager of my own biodiversity reserve, I was facing these dilemmas, the bad marriage, quick divorce dilemma. I was facing these dilemmas in a more gut-wrenching way than I had ever encountered in the classroom. And I'm quoting her now. Pressured by environmental authorities to cull kangaroos on my property in the name of ecological ethics, I started thinking about the very meaning of ethics and its origins in the evolution of society and its material and metaphysical presuppositions. From this basis, Matthews explores, quote, two different conceptions of the normative root of society, the deontic or deontic, appropriate, she says, within the material and metaphysical framework of hunter-gatherer societies, and the axial conception, appropriate within the framework of what she calls civilization in inverted commas, viz. The agrarian societies that evolved into the urban industrial formations of the modern era. The axial conception is based on empathy, and it underlies, she says, our contemporary sense of animal ethics, while ecological ethics, on the other hand, is underpinned by a deontic conception, not ethical at all in the axial sense, and mismatched, normatively speaking, with the material and metaphysical practices of modern societies. And she concludes that, quote, a different set of practices from those currently prescribed by environmental authorities needs to be devised to meet both the ethical and ecological requirements of our contemporary natural environment. And for axials, as it were, that is the empathetic approach to ethics, for axials, as she points out, all animals, whether wild, tame, free, enslaved, exploited, call on our empathy, have moral worth. I'll draw on Freya Matthews' article again later, but for now I want not to go, as it were, into the background that Sargoff and Matthews draw in terms of these issues, but to move on to a subset that flows from these. And this is within not so much the axial in her terms, but what she sees as the less appropriate ethical framework for consideration of animals in our time, that is the deontic view, which underpins most contemporary environmentalism and in practice directs conservation policies in many places throughout the globe, most particularly the former settler colonies such as South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States. In all these countries, parks and wildlife authorities, and I use the Australian term parks and wildlife authorities because it's called something different in every country, but recognisably parks and wildlife, or a term for the government departments that oversee conservation practice. Parks and wildlife philosophy and practices can be placed squarely in the ethically deontic corner, concerned with the preservation of species as a whole, ecosystems, and thus, to a point, animal habitats, but not concerned with individual animals or necessarily their welfare. In the face of increasing human overpopulation, and thus in the face of that most euphemistic of terms, whether we're deontically or axially inclined ethically, that most euphemistic of terms, habitat loss, which after all is put in the passive, is subjectless term, glosses either or both, relentless human population expansion or sheer human greed, habitat loss can be seen as the greatest threat to both animal welfare and ecosystem species conservation worldwide. In the face of habitat loss, which being axially inclined, I would want to see as applying not just to wildlife and wildlife ecosystems, but to exploited domestic animals in the unconscionable conditions of factory farming, or, for instance, in circuses where they still exist, or non-breeding zoos. Habitat loss due to us does offend both ethical systems. So given this, it can seem rather churlish to criticise conservation measures designed to ensure that wild ecosystems, at least, remain as undisturbed as possible by humans, to sequester them from destructive human intrusions and the human intrusions that are a subset of direct intrusion, the things we bring with us, the things we introduce. But it is the current practice of much wildlife, national park, ecosystem conservation, especially, as I said, in what Alfred Crosby terms the Neo-Europes, that needs to be looked at a little more closely. Much of this effort, and I'll focus first on Australia and New Zealand for another reason, before briefly mentioning, as I said in my abstract, the Farallon Islands at the end. Most of the effort of parks and wildlife is, with its deontic ethics, is aimed at preserving and sequestering current ecosystems. While this, of course, means, as Matthews finds in her own case, that empathetic or axial ethics are completely set aside. Sometimes there's a deleterious result for the ecosystem itself from these parks and wildlife practices, but certainly it's deleterious for many animals. If I take a recent example that I observed on an island just off the Barrier Reef, to give you an example of this sort of approach, though I think you're all familiar with it. Goats were put on that island in the late 19th, early 20th century to provide food for shipwrecked sailors. A bush, lantana, was inadvertently introduced. Parks and Wildlife are determined to get rid of the goats, which they say are eating the vegetation, but they also want to get rid of the lantana, which has taken over the rest of the vegetation. Therefore, they embarked on a scheme for both shooting goats from helicopters, which leaves, of course, a lot of goats just injured and dying, not necessarily killed, and burning the lantana in order to both get rid of the lantana but also to drive the goats out of the lantana. The deleterious result in this case was for the operation itself was that the lantana came back again because they didn't get all of it, and there were no longer any goats, except the ones I and someone else hid in an old shelter to eat the lantana. But that island also had wallabies and kangaroos, and nothing was done to protect the wallabies and kangaroos. They just had to fend for themselves in the fire as best they could. They weren't targeted because they were indigenous, but they were left to fend for themselves. Now, while this is one example of the practice of a deontic ethic, it also rests on a radical distinction being made between indigenous components of the ecosystem and the alien invaders, the non-indigenous animals and plants like the goats and the lantana, usurping, it's believed, indigenous territory, or in some cases having over time possibly reached a reasonable accommodation with the biota of the existing ecosystem, though that is not really in the philosophy of most parks and wildlife conservation departments. Islands, more than anywhere else on Earth, especially if they are small and remote, offer greater chances of preserving indigenous species and ecosystems than, say, continental or mainland sites. But what exactly does being indigenous mean? As Darwin pointed out, islands are the cradles of evolution. They promote, in their relative isolation, relatively rapid speciation, the creation in the short term of new species of plants and animals. But islands are cradles of evolution for the opposite reason, because they are not wholly isolated. The surrounding sea or air brings animals and plants from proximate land, or if humans are involved, they bring intentionally or unintentionally animals and plants with them. Thus, what arrives on apparently pristine island, Surtsey off Iceland would be one, comes up, is within climatic, of course, and topographic possibilities, quite adventitious. Evolution is then an adventitious process in space and one without beginning or end in time. To designate species as indigenous then requires an artificial stasis being imposed on a naturally dynamic process. In the settler colonies, environmental protection and practices, that is, conservation, relying as it does on foregrounding the indigenous at every turn, generally relies for its definition of indigenous on the date of the arrival of the invasive Europeans, i.e. us, and in Australia that becomes 1788, a kind of date for indigeneity that's ironic in many senses, not least because, of course, in the arrivals of 1788 and after, nothing that was indigenous, including people, was either valued or protected. But it also is ironic in that we admit to have been the primary agent of destruction by picking 1788, but we also imagine that the land, the flora and fauna before our arrival, existed in a state of geological and biological stasis, and that in trying to preserve the indigenous now, it argues that our presence, which remains undiminished, indeed increased exponentially, can recover the purity before our arrival. We know in geological time, for instance, that stasis was never the case, but when we come to the shorter term timescale, we refuse to acknowledge the dynamic nature of that evolutionary process. Thus, the very definition of indigenous in terms of flora and fauna becomes an inherently artificial one. But the determined protection of these indigenous species and ecosystems at the expense of those, or indeed the eradication of those who arrived in the course of evolution after 1788 or were deliberately and accidentally introduced by us, is not only without logical foundation, but can have and has been known to have destabilizing and destructive effects, not just on individual animals and species, but on ecosystems as a whole. And particularly in an era of unstoppable global exchange and climate change, the effects, of course, of which we're already seeing, the application of what I term fundamentalist 1788 parks and wildlife policy risks further damage. Perhaps most importantly, these arrivals after the cutoff date of 1788 usually affect some kind of ecological accommodation with the existing biota over time, forming sometimes new accommodations and communities. Again, though, I'd want to stress the point that preservation of biodiversity and thus of Indigenous species, and they may in practice overlap, and is without doubt a good thing, but they don't always overlap. And as people are beginning to theorise, biodiversity and indigeneity may have to be in some ways separated. By no means always the case that they are the same. Moreover, the application of an apparently deontic ethic, of which preservation of the indigenous is understood as a corollary, results in what Tom Van Doren refers to as cruel conservation, by which he means the sort of thing I was talking about with the goats. I want now to look at ways in which these conflicting ethical principles, focused on the preservation of Indigenous flora and fauna on an isolated island, play out or will play out next year. It's the island on which I live, off the Australian coast, Lord Howe Island. It lies 800 kilometres from the coast and is politically a part of the state of New South Wales, but geologically, like Surtsey, it is sui generis. It's the product of a volcanic eruption in the ocean, and it was once much larger, though over time has been reduced by oceanic erosion to less than 30% of its original size. No humans were present there until 1788, when it was accidentally discovered by ships of the First Fleet, 1788, returning to England. It represents an extreme case in several ways. It's so far from mainland coasts, it has a unique flora and fauna, with indigenous species whose ancestries, so far as they can be traced, are New Zealand, Vanuatu, Australia, and even more puzzlingly, two species of plant from South Africa, which it's assumed birds must have brought. Although settled by humans during the 19th century, it was never heavily settled, and its current permanent human population of 350 plus about 400 tourists at any one time adds up to quite a small human population on an island which is admittedly only 11 kilometres long, is a World Heritage Area and mountainous on both ends, so the human population numbers are concentrated in the middle. Rats, those persisting human companions, arrived in 1918 on the island, and mice a little earlier in the late 19th century. Rats do attack and did attack nesting birds and chicks of both seabirds and land birds, and are thought to be endangering a species of endemic snail, an endemic lizard, and are inhibiting or really preventing the return of an endemic phasmid, stick insect, once abundant on the island, and believed to be extinct but recovered from a rock stack near the island in 2000. I can talk more about that later if anyone's interested. But both the numbers of rats and their actual potential damage is being vastly exaggerated. The situation on the island is not ideal in terms of rats, but arguably, but unprovably from a scientific point of view, they have, over the last almost 100 years, reached an accommodation with many of the endemics on the island. Indeed, quite a few of the bird numbers have increased. It needs to be said that one of these is also the Providence petrel, a species of bird that nests only on that particular island. And most notably, the bird, the woodhen, which was brought back from the brink of extinction by humans, who were not responsible, the rats weren't, for its near extinction in the first place. Indeed, as with most of the endemic species, we know to have become extinct on that island since the 19th century, humans have been the ones involved. Farmers shooting the parrot, for instance, which is now extinct because the parrots ate the crops. But enter an important player in island conservation in the last 20 years. A New Zealand company, together with the New Zealand government, has formed a profitable industry, and this is becoming a problem of conservation worldwide, which is the major commodification of the conservation industry. A major New Zealand company, together with the New Zealand government, has become specialists and in fact purveyors to the world of helicopter poison drops as a kind of total solution to the rat problem. We have had rat control on Lord Howe for many, many years with baits contained in bait in stations which keep birds out and so on. But this is control, not eradication. And the New Zealand company has increasingly made, on at least 60 islands now, eradication the way everything should go, especially in relation to rats, but not only rats, rabbits, stoats, and in New Zealand, possums as well. What this involves is a derivative of the poison 1080 related to warfarin, but in concentrated amounts dropped by helicopter all over the island in two-day bursts. Rats, of course, being very smart, learn very quickly not to eat poisons when they see other rats die, but if this is done very quickly, it's thought they won't catch on, at least this is. This conservation, so-called conservation measure, has become New Zealand's seventh largest export. And as Prime Minister Keyes, enthused by the money this is making for New Zealand, said the other day, we will rid New Zealand of every possum, rat, stoat, and alien vermin by the year 2050. To do this, he needs an experiment, not he personally, but the company, needs an experiment that will work on a populated island. So far, although they have done, as it were, with varying results, some failures over 60 islands, none of them have had a permanent human population. We would be the first where there is a permanent human population to have this done. From the point of view of animal ethics, however, Freya Matthews' axial approach, Tom Van Doren's cruel conservation, it is an example of what this will be at its worst. Applying the fundamentalist environmental 1788 law, it means that of all birds on the island likely to be affected by this process, only the endangered woodhens and the currawongs will receive protection. As many as possible of the 200 woodhens, they were once down to 12, as I said, people, not rats, were responsible for that, will be captured and interned. The rest will certainly die, as they will probably eat some of the baits directly, or they will eat dead and dying rats. The Lord Howe Island currawong, a subspecies of the mainland currawong, will have 60% of its complement captured and interned. Both are territorial, particularly the woodhen, and both will therefore be put under great stress. The others, like leftover woodhens, will die from, in their case, secondary or primary poisoning. The poison is dropped in grain-covered pellets, so whatever birds. both because the poison is presented in that form of grain feed, other land birds without the 1788 protection will assuredly die also, at least four different kinds. Owls, imported to prey on the rats, but now themselves subject to parks and wildlife eradication, will also be the victims of the poison drop, which will be timed when the Providence petrels, who nest, as I said, in very rare migratory, will not be there. But the active life of Broad Africom is much debated. Much of the poison will go into the sea because we have very, very steep cliffs. And while little research has been done on reef ecosystems as a whole, only on fish and mussels, fish because those are the most likely ones to be affected, it's known that after 3 years of a failed poison drop on Gough Island, which was an American base, fish have remained so-called inedible for at least 3 years. Domestic animals will also be subject to various measures. All the chickens will be killed. The cows allegedly will also be killed, not because there's a worry that they will eat the baits. They will probably not eat enough to kill them. It would make them sick. A vitamin K injection could revive them, but because they will eat baits intended for the rats, and the proponents of the scheme don't want any watering down of this scheme. Dogs, which are the only pets allowed on the island, will have to wear muzzles for many months. Broad Africom is an anticoagulant. It dissolves blood vessel walls very slowly in the manner of Ebola. Victims take between 2 and 12 painful days to die. This is whether it's rats or birds. It's a very cruel death, particularly when, if you're absolutely determined to eradicate rats at any cost, then there's no available an alternative. The 6th of August this year, the American EPA approved fertility culling outside of laboratory conditions for use across the states. Fertility culling targets rats only, but it's been rejected on the grounds that it is too slow. It takes a while for this to pass down. It is therefore not called eradication, but only another means of control. This practice of cruel conservation can seem to make sense on Lord Howe because it is ostensibly designed to preserve very valuable indigenous animals and plants from supposed rat depredation, thus ensuring local and global biodiversity, a very worthy conservation ideal. But it is already designed to fail, and if anyone is interested, I can go into the reasons why. The primary object is highly unlikely to succeed on the island. Rats are, par excellence, the non-indigenous alien invader of them all. Although without doubt, and I'm talking here Rattus rattus, the common rat, or Rattus norvegicus in different places, not a lot of the evolved rats in other places. In fact, the rarest animal in the world at the moment, I believe, is a Malaysian rat. Rattus rattus, or Rattus norvegicus, no doubt accompanied the convict arrivals in Australia. So they came, let's say, in 1788, but they've always been regarded as destructive, invasive aliens, and usually are wherever they go. They may have originated in Southeast and Northern Asia, as we originated presumably in Africa, and they have been our very own invading companions across the globe. They're not only with us, but so like us in behaviour, unstoppable, opportunistic, omnivorous, so like us that many of us in the room would not be here today without them. Most pre-human trial, medical and pharmacological experiments are carried out on them. But from a purely ecological, environmental point of view, they are given no ecosystem role whatsoever and always represented, understandably, in some ways, deservedly or undeservedly, as invaders and destroyers, no matter how long they've resided in a particular place or existed side by side with indigenous ecosystems. Rats, like sharks or bats, of course, also carry an enormous symbolic freight. Plague, humans being eaten by rats, rats swarming down walls, or people dropped into pits by rats. And they're perpetually made into the stuff of nightmare. And they, rarely us, are charged with destroying allegedly pristine pre-colonial natural paradises. Not unreasonably, perhaps, it is on islands that the possibilities of reconstituting a particular, albeit static, ecosystem is most likely to be offered, if, of course, further alien invasions of animals and plants are kept at bay. Hence the current targeting by Parks and Wildlife of rat and other so-called pest alien invaders. But there's a much less laudable intention here, even if we accept the notion that we can retrieve island ecosystems, and that is the economic one I mentioned earlier. Less financially self-interested environmentalists argue that, quote, we brought the rats, so it's our duty to remove them. But it's difficult not to believe that rats are frequently being made scapegoats for our own destructiveness, and removing them becomes proxy for the unthinkable removal of us. Removing rats, and it is hoped mice, from an ecosystem potentially accommodated to their presence for nearly 100 years, we're likely to do much more harm than good, both in the short term and the long term, and to not, in any case, achieve the primary aim. I've had little time to talk about the fella on islands. It's a wildlife refuge off the coast of San Francisco, where the same process is being proposed, but at the moment 32,000 signatures, objections to it, are being kept at bay. Conclude by not solving this problem, by simply saying, by invoking returns to a pre-rat or pre-alien pristine ecosystems, that is, attempting to halt the evolutionary processes, we may in fact be compromising a future in which the overall goal of maintaining biodiversity on the planet becomes seriously compromised. Biodiversity and endemicity are not synonymous. We may have to face the fact that the practice of cruel conservation, the axial view, does not even give us a good deontic result. More than any other species on Earth, rats are us. They are our psychological, physiological, medical surrogates and the scapegoats for our own destructive place on the Earth's biodiversity. Remove them, and the burden of our own presence and guilt is at least somewhat lessened. But as Fred Pearce argues in his book, The New Wild, quote, what conservation should really be about in the 21st century should not be about trying to preserve nature in aspect, still less about trying to recreate the past. In the 21st century, rather than fighting a losing battle to protect what we imagine to be pristine nature, we should be encouraging nature's rebirth, often through the dynamism of invasive instincts of alien species, end of quote. No one, of course, including Pearce, wishes to, quote, encourage rats or destructive humans into apparently natural ecosystems. But by determining to totally eradicate them at any cost, we not only do, to return to Freya Matthews' terms, potential environmental damage in the name of a deontic ethic, but violate through cruel conservation the axial principle of empathy, with animals. The ethic Matthew certainly sees as the one most appropriate in our own times. While arguing a practical rather than ethical point, Pierce also sees as the only way forward. Thank you.